Welcome to the Boost VC podcast. At Boost VC, we are the accelerator that invests the first $500,000 into sci-fi tech startups. And this show is all about talking to investors and founders to dig into the latest topics around sci-fi tech and building great companies. I'm your host, Adam Draper, founder and managing director of Boost VC. Are you ready to rock? How many of you have a pet out there? So it turns out pets are big business. And Emily Dong is here today to talk about the industry of vets and how insurance in the US is different than international and how you should be insuring your pet. Emily Dong has been building this company for 4 years. She is bringing veterinary clinics to the digital era, and we at Boost VC are very fortunate to be investors, but also she is a dog person, and I'm sorry for all those cat people. So without further ado, please listen.
All right, today we are joined by Emily Dong, who is the CEO and founder of Snout. Welcome, Emily. Thanks for joining.
Great to be here.
So what Emily does is she's founded a company. It was previously called Pawprint with a consumer focus, but she has migrated towards modernizing all veterinary and pet clinics to not have paper so that it can be digitized. So Emily, what made you want to do this? Or why don't you introduce yourself first? I probably butchered it in some form.
I think that was great, but I'll tell you, I'll start with that story. I think it's a good one. So okay. I got a dog in 2010, and I state the year because it's important to see where we are in the course of technology in the vet industry. What I found is when I try to travel and drop him off with boarding or even get a haircut at the groomer, every single time they ask me for proof of vaccination. So I was like, I don't have that. So I'm just going to call the next one. And I would call four or five different places and they all needed it. So I finally gave in. I called my vet. I said, I need these records. And they said, great. What's your fax number? We're going to fax it to you. And that's why I say it's 2010, because I was like,
it is crazy that like billions of dollars that are going to be made by just replacing the fax machine still. Like it's...
A part of me has accepted that we're not going to replace the fax machine. So they've converted me. And what I've realized is in physical industries like veterinary, where you're, you know, dealing with a lot of things, not like us, we're doing computer work, right? So veterinary, restaurants, they all still use that because they need something to be printed out and in your face. So we actually use a lot of e-fax to get records from the vets. That's part of our...
So wait, you use e-fax. So they go from fax to your email.
They do, yes.
So it's like the reverse, it's like the half the fax. I remember a long time ago, the first company that did that. That's crazy. I can't believe it's still happening. But, you know, there, I think also some of it's bureaucracy. Like a lot of like legal is still like you need to sign it in person or you have to notarize it or like, you know, you have to make sure that the doctor actually signs it probably for a lot of things, or the vet signs it.
The vet has to sign it. Or, I mean, even what we were just talking about before we started recording about having all the files behind you, right? The vets legally have to keep that for, depending on the state, I think it's 3 to 5 years.
What do you say? So, they still have to do that?
They have to keep it. So either you're going to keep it or you're going to have to ship truckloads of paper to someone to scan everything in, right? So
how do we remove all the paper? Can we remove it all, or is that just never going to happen? Like, is that...
I think it's a slow process, right? Like, I mean, I wish we could just snap our fingers. There's no more of that. But I think the way it works is for us, every time somebody comes into the practice, we digitize all their stuff. So we get all of your medical records from all the practices you've been to before. Particularly if you've moved around, there may be 3 or 4 of those. You sign all your paperwork through us, and then at that point, everything is digital and your old file is no longer relevant.
Do the animals have to sign also on your platform?
They don't cooperate with us, but part of the reason we named it Snout is for dogs, their nose is like their fingerprint.
Dude, it would be adorable to see a dog on an iPad, like, doing something, like, with their paw and just saying.
Yeah, I think if cameras get clear enough, maybe they boop it with their nose.
Oh, that'd be
and that's how they check in. They're like, boop.
The sign-in is, like, you have to take a picture of the person and the dog. So it's like.
Yes. And then we have to verify relations.
So are you a dog or a cat person? Or are you... Are you, as running a company, you're not allowed to pick? Am I not allowed?
I think I'm not allowed to say, but I have a dog, so.
Sorry, cat people out there.
We are very supportive of cats.
By the way, I remember the first time we talked, it was like probably 2.5 years ago, not 3 years ago. But I asked you a very specific question, and you gave me an amazing answer. I asked you, and maybe you don't have this information anymore, but. I said, okay, so you've all this data on all these pets. You have like 700,000 records. What is the most popular dog name?
And I remember this one. Yeah.
Do you remember what the name was?
It was Bella.
It was.
It well was done. Bella.
It was Bella. And then we had a whole conversation about Twilight. So like it's crazy. I mean, that is really interesting that like Bella, everyone chose as the best dog name of 2019 or whatever, 2018.
Yeah, I mean, we went a little further than that. I think Bella was most common for chocolate labs in particular, but
you're like, we just happen to have 30% chocolate labs on the
market. Yeah, they're very popular dogs.
You're like, if you own a chocolate lab, then you'll enjoy Paw Print or you'll enjoy
Smith. Yeah, yeah, and 30% chance you'll name it Bella.
Okay, so how do you think about this animal market? You know, we've had the huge successes of the food, right? Like the food business, Chewy, and is that the company? There's a company.
I mean, Chewy sells a lot of things, everything under the sun. Bought some tennis balls and toothbrushes from them.
For dogs, though, right? Like it's
big. Pets,
all for pets. So there's this pet, like there are a couple billion-dollar
companies. Food, pharmacy, toys, everything.
And so how do you think about the market in general? What time is not being spent on that really needs time allocated to it in the pet market?
I really think it's healthcare, and that's why I do what we're doing, right? I think vet care is largely ignored. A lot of people, they get a dog.
How many pets are like insured? Is that a thing?
Yeah, yeah. So it's 2-5% depending on who you ask, but it's a very, very low number. And another shocking number is 30% of vets have never been to the vet. They only go when it's a near-death experience, right? And part of that is the costs are high and they're very unexpected. So it's scary. If something happens to your dog...
30% of vets have not been to the vet? Like
30% of pets.
So oh, like pets. Pet. I was like, 30% of
the
vets.
The vets have all been there.
I'm like, I hope they've all been to another veterinary clinic.
Yeah.
Or their own. Pets have not been to the vet because it's only if something's really, really bad.
Yeah, because people don't know what the basic maintenance they need to do is, right? There's a lot of preventative care that, you know, people gloss over or they're afraid, right? So if you don't have insurance, it's scary to go to the doctor because you have no idea what that bill is going to be. And even for us as humans, right, we go to the doctor, you ask them how much it's going to cost. And even if they wanted to tell you, nobody in the room knows.
No one knows
what you're part of.
It's not, I'm having an appendix removed. It's $500. It's like, I don't know. Like the insurance will figure it out. Like
they'll figure it out. But then in the vet space, there's no insurance. So it's like, you will figure it out. Or we're going to take your dog or we're going to put them down. And so 5 million pets each year are euthanized because of that.
Five million pets?
5 million. And that's not counting the pets that, you know, are just.
Wait, how many pets are actually in the U.S.?
200 million.
Wait, so it's almost 1-to-1? It's like there's two pets for every one.
No, 200 million are in the U.S. 5 million are euthanized.
No, I'm just saying that there's 300 million people in the United States and there are 200 million people, like pets. That doesn't mean 1-to-1. Like some people have 20.
Is that true?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's 350 million, something like that.
No, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
It's like 70% of people. It's like 70% of people have pets. Like, that's what it sounds like if you
have
1-to-1.
But then, you know, some people have 5 cats and 3 dogs. And
yeah, like Tiger King. Or a bunch of tigers.
Yes.
Is there a market in the world where, like, pet insurance is a thing? Like, way more adopted?
Like, yeah, in the UK, I think in the European models where everyone is used to having universal healthcare, it's a very basic concept for them to also insure their pet. There's a movement here. Insurance here, even though it's a small number, is growing 20% year over year. So it's very fast growth.
And who are the big players? Is it the same healthcare provider? Is it like United Blue Cross? Like, does
No. Pets? So pets are technically property. So it's PNC insurance.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so they're totally different players. The biggest ones are like Trupanion, Healthy Paws, Pet Plan. There are also new ones launching every month because I think everyone is realizing that this is such a big problem. There's a couple that do all kinds of insurance, like Nationwide has a really big pet arm. They're one of the biggest pet insurance.
I heard pets, like the purchase of pets during the pandemic. Wow, that say that five times fast. During the pandemic. grew
Piper at, pepper.
It grew at like 5x. It was like it's 5x bigger.
Mm-hmm. I've heard different numbers, but what I do know is people are like, oh, I want to get a dog. I can't find one. I'm like, I don't know what to tell you. You're too late.
The high demand.
They're gone.
And you're like, are you going to insure it?
Yeah. I'm like, that's the it thing, right? Like you get a dog because it's cute. And people get them for Christmas and things like that. And then you don't think about all the maintenance and taking care of it and the health that goes.
No, supposedly people would rather, they took a poll and people, I mean, this is people talking, like wanting to say that they're, but people would rather stop buying themselves food than their dog or something. Like they would, feeding the dog is like the last
puppy thing. Eyes if you don't feed them. So
it's like the last thing though. But the polled people were probably like it was probably a very high density of dog people, dog lovers. Okay. So this market's growing, but the biggest company is probably what? $1 billion company, $2 billion company, maybe.
Well, yeah, Chewy's pretty big.
Chewy's big, but it's like an e-commerce company.
Chewy's big. I mean, even Trupanion. Trupanion is the, I would say, fourth largest insurance company, and they're public and valued at over $1 billion too.
Okay, so this market's big, it's growing. What do people just need to know about it? Like, I'm sort of assuming that a bunch of people who are listening like have pets. Like, what do they need to know about insurance? Like, what's the cost of insurance, I guess?
Cost depends on where you are, right? Because the average vet appointment in Kentucky is probably $150. In Manhattan, it's probably $450. So they take your zip code, they take the breed. For example, Frenchies have tons of issues. And mutts are actually generally healthier.
That's interesting. See, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And certain dogs, like golden retrievers, are more prone to cancer, or you know, bigger dogs have hip dysplasia. So there's different things that factor into that.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend who, in the Silicon Valley in California, they got an estimate for a certain surgery for their dog. And then they were originally from Texas, so they got an estimate from Texas. And it was a $20,000 difference.
Wow.
So they actually, what they did was they flew the dog to Texas to have the surgery, and they still saved money.
Oh my God, their dog did medical tourism.
Yep.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so it's like there is a odd like surgeon arbitrage also of veterinary. Like there's...
Totally.
There are a lot of problems in this space. Why, like, we're glad you're fixing them, Emily.
We can't solve it all, but the main thing I'm thinking about these days is how do we make sure that everybody can afford pet care, and going to the vet is not a scary thing, right? If there's something wrong with your pet, take them in.
So equalizing healthcare for all humans is sort of your, like, making it feel affordable, accessible. The snout way.
Snout. You're going to write a few taglines for us today.
Good. Well, you know, that's what I'm here for. While building out this company, so one of the things that I always admire about like successful entrepreneurs at the end, like in the future, it's always at the beginning, there was skepticism. And your market feels like, I mean, that's sort of where our sci-fi tagline comes from. It's sort of like you have to go through unreasonable skepticism from your family is essentially the group. Mm-hmm. What was the biggest struggle, though, for you going through building this company? Like, was it building trust? Was it building believers? Was it, I don't know, like, What's been the hardest?
It's all been insanely hard. And I actually recently spoke with the entrepreneurship class at USC, which is my alma mater. And I was like, it's really hard. It's harder than you think it is. And then it's harder than that. But I think, I cannot stress enough how difficult this is. Nobody will believe in you for the first 3 years.
Yes.
I think for us in particular, the hardest part was finding the business model. So as you know, and I think is true of a lot of your investments, right? With your thesis, is we didn't have a business model for the first few years when we were running Pawprint. We just knew that the data was valuable, that the paper is horribly inefficient. That sucks for the vet. It sucks for the pet owner. There's a big problem here. But we didn't know should the pet owner pay for it? Should the vet pay for it? Where do we make money? And we were we want everything to be free because we want everyone to be able to use it. So I think that's another common mistake of early entrepreneurs, right?
The idealism, the idealism of entrepreneurship. I recently wrote a post called Money is Good, because I feel that there's this weird trend of idealism where you want everything to be free because that means it's accessible, right? That means it's
exactly.
But there's nothing powering
you. We think everyone should have access to it.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, you do need to be sustainable so you can deliver that service, right? And so that's what building a big business is all about. You need the good and greed is the wrong word, but it's that vibe where you do need to make money. You need that.
There's a balance. There's definitely a balance. And it's figuring out who sees the most value, right? I think the shift in mentality I had was rather than free, everyone should have it, is what problem are we solving where today they're spending X dollars? Or if they use our product, they would make X more dollars.
That's interesting. So you thought about it as where are they spending dollars today? We can either replace that or make them save or make more money.
Right. Yeah. So for example, with us, we're saving their front desk now a ton of time because they're not scanning in paperwork, right? And printing it out and bringing it to you. So that takes 20 minutes every time they need you to sign anything. So that's money saved. That is more than what our solution costs. And then if people end up buying insurance or engaging with our other financial products, they then opt into more services and they end up spending twice as much at the vet. So our vets right now are up 60% in revenue. And so I don't feel bad about the money I'm charging you if you are making $1 million more a year.
And now you have the data to prove that. And now you have a business model.
Now we have 5 years in, we have a business model.
Wait till you're 10. It's going to be well, that didn't work. But you have to get there, right?
Don't say that. Yeah, it's a survival game. But
this entrepreneur I backed, the company's called Amplitude. It's a really big company. The guy's name is Spencer Skip.
I went to high school with one of their founders.
Curtis?
Not Curtis, I'm Jeffrey.
Oh, okay. Yes. Spencer, he once pulled me after he spoke at Boost VC, he said he had just raised a lot of money. And he was like, I used to think that scale of a startup meant more sales, more, mm-hmm. more. But really what it meant was reinventing the company every 24 months. And that is what happens. Essentially, you have to follow where you have to recreate the business at every level and every scale. And it's an interesting way to think about it. You're a different business than you were 5 years ago, than 3 years ago, than 1 year ago, probably.
Yeah.
You've had to follow where you felt the pulse of the market was. How has your perspective of the business or the market of pets changed over the course of that time? You've been doing this 4 or 5 years now. How has your perspective of this business changed? Do you know too much now?
I do. I know too much. I can't it's taking up a lot of space. But I think the most general trend I can say is we learn to follow the money in B2B. So with B2B, our customers, they tell us what they want. They're like, we want this feature. You build it, we'll use it. We started with consumer because that was a problem that we understood and we had. So it's very easy from a product perspective to say, this is what I want and build it. But with consumer, it kind of feels like the lottery, right? Either everyone discovers you and it takes off or it doesn't. And strangely, in our case, we got caught in this no man's land where people loved us. We were the number one pet health app, but we couldn't make money, right? So yeah, I think a lot of the learnings is just
money.
Where is the value?
Yeah.
Where is it? Yeah.
I think that for founders, it's one of the most important things to think about at some level is like, if you are going to scale or you're doing it for the public good and you can, but you need to still figure out how to finance it and like
that. Yeah. Unavoidable.
It's wild. I think entrepreneurs generally do have this element of idealism, and it's so important to be able to think, hey, I can change this thing. Like, you have to be a little idealist, like, I could change this. But then also, there has to be this practical, like, make money to sustain and build and make impact. I always think Apple has made more impact on the world than, like, any nonprofit or all nonprofits collectively, right? Like, so, you know, make money. You can make impact. Money's good. Yeah. Okay. Where are you personally? We always try to focus on sort of the founders at Boost. And where are you personally very competitive in your life?
Where am I personally very competitive in my life? In terms of projects, in terms of hobbies.
Everything. Like, do you consider yourself a competitive person? I should first ask.
Totally. Yeah. If I don't think I can win, I don't want to play. I think that's a trait I've had since I was very young. Like, can I win? Okay, let's play.
I like it. So it's almost like you're in the corner, like training, and then you're like, okay, I'm ready to play. So,
yeah. And I mean, I think one of the stories that I tell people sometimes, and I very rarely share this, but I did ballet since I was 5 years old. And when I was in my teens, I had an opportunity where my teacher wanted me to go and try out for company and go professional. And I loved it. I would have loved to do that. But then I thought about it and I looked out there and I was like, I will be good. Like, I will make it. I can be a pro, but I can't be the best. Like, I looked at where they were and I was like, I'm not there. I don't have that level of artistry. I don't enjoy the theatrical part of it. I'm just not going to get there. And so I was like, it's not worth it for me to do it, even if I love it, because I'm not going to be that great.
That's
not gonna be the best.
That's super interesting. So you tested a couple more things, and one of them ended up being entrepreneurship for pets. And you're like, I can be the best here.
I don't know. Yeah, let's see. Let's find out.
You have the skill set. By the way, on your ballet story, so I played tennis, and I had a similar experience where I was trying to go pro. And I realized at every tournament, the person I was playing, like some of them, you know, they needed to win the tournament to make money to pay for their family to like food, right?
Yep.
And I didn't have the desperation there.
Yeah.
And I don't think I ever realized that I wasn't quite good enough, but I was looking back.
You have to have the drive.
But for the thing, you have to have the drive for that one thing and that like there's a desperation drive for that. And like, I do feel it when I'm in venture capital. I do feel like I'm playing in the NBA and that I'm trying to, like, I'm going to play basketball, I'm going to play in the NBA. And if I'm going to like win big, and like, I do feel I have the skill set for it. I think you're right. Like it's like I got so far and you got so far towards like being professional at this thing. And then you were like, you tried it on and you're like, not for me this time. What did you do after that? What was the decision like that you ran towards after you were like, no to ballet?
I mean, I still do it. I love it. I really enjoy it. It'll always be a part of my life. And I think I learned a lot from it, right? Just like
ballet is like super competitive, right?
It's like the never ending pursuit of perfection. Like, nobody is going to be perfect at ballet. You can't. Like, our bodies don't work that way.
So how do you get better then? Like, what is it? Is it better is just different? Or is better like?
I mean, I think when I peaked, I was training like 3 hours a day one summer and doing some other like running or sports. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, but I ended up going to college instead. That is the answer to your question.
Awesome. To USC.
Got an education.
And
yeah.
Do you have any stories from like your childhood that made you think, oh, eventually I was going to start a business? Or like where do you think that like realization even came from? So you were competitive in ballet.
Yeah. My parents are immigrants. So they came from China. They have the classic story that I hear amongst a lot of my friends where they came, they had $20 in their pocket. My dad delivered food. He did plumbing. My mom was a seamstress. I think she was a paralegal for a while, anything to make ends meet. And then my dad ended up starting his own business. And that is what allowed me to go to college and not have to worry about debt and things like that. And so I think just watching my parents hustle all of their lives, you know, made me feel like it gave me the purpose, right? Like they worked so hard so that I could have these opportunities, and now I want to take advantage of that and be the best that I can be.
Can't not stop. Yeah. That's sort of a commonality amongst most founders. It's sort of like, no matter what, there would be this pursuit, you know, like there's always a actually, in some ways, founding a company is a lot like the pursuit of perfection that you're talking about. It's like figuring out exactly, but you it's also imperfection. Like it is.
I mean, every day you get better. Every day you get a little closer to your goal. You're not going to get there tomorrow, but you have to every day take steps towards it.
Yeah. And like we always talk about, especially during the pandemic, I'm not sure if you had any, have any like advice on how to deal with like burnout and stuff. But the during the pandemic, we as a Boost VC team, we've been saying, celebrate the little wins and always have something to look forward to. Like those have been our sort of our mantra of like during this only remote era that we're in. Have you ever burned out? Have you ever just been like, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And how do you deal with it?
I mean, I got this Aura ring, which I love. I realized that a lot of the burnout.
What is that? What is that thing? What's that ring?
It's like a tracker. So it tracks your steps. It tracks your sleep. So I think the biggest thing I learned from this is even if you're in bed for 8 hours, I'd be like, I slept so much. You probably only slept 6.5 hours because you're falling asleep.
This is a big trend, is like very much making sure that your sleep is high quality, right? Like the.
It is a trend. Yeah.
I have a bunch of friends.
Working out, sleeping. Yeah, working out and sleeping. I think those are the two main things for me. So I realize that if I'm consistent about those things, then I have a lot of energy for other stuff. But before, when I was burning out, you know, I was like, you know, I'll work, you know, 16 hours a day and I'll just eat in between. And that's not sustainable. So at some point you're going to burn out, right? So you gotta do what you continue doing for many years. And when I first started the company, the way I was living was probably only sustainable for 12 months max.
And how is the, you know, you were saying earlier that you were coaching the, well, not coaching, but you were explaining starting a company. You said, as hard as you think it is, and then it's harder, and then it's harder than that. Which is a great quote, by the way. How has it incrementally been, like, where were the hard parts? And how is the beginning harder? How is it different hard? Like, at the beginning, I feel like the problems are different than where you are now, right? Like what is that difference? Like one is spending enough time and grinding, and now it's like, I don't know. I feel you're probably in a more strategic mindset. I don't know. Like I would love to understand from your perspective, what you think was difficult in the first year and now.
Yeah. So I think in the first couple years, actually, amongst my entrepreneur friends and I, we call this like the existential crisis phase. So you're creating a thing. You think it should be out there, but nobody else thinks it should be out there yet. And so it's like, you know, what is your existential purpose, right? And in that stage, anything can kill you. Like the wind blows tomorrow, the company shuts down. Like you have nothing. And yeah, and the only thing that's keeping the company going is your desire for it to keep going. And that's when they say the company dies when the founder quits. Doesn't die when you run out of money, because you can continue working if you want, right? So...
Well, yeah, no. So basically your existential power powers the startup. And that's also why when founders leave, sometimes companies do die, even if it's bigger or it evolves into something completely different, because the purpose has gone. Like that was...
The thing driving it, right?
The thing driving it, the energy source that everyone had. So, okay, I love existential crisis phase. That's fun.
Yeah. I think that was the most stressful, because I would go into these dark tunnels. And that's like an emotional thing, right? Because I would work so hard, but then I was like, I would poke my head up. I'm like, what if we're working on the wrong thing? I'm just working 16 hours a day on the wrong thing. We don't even know what the thing that we're making is yet. And so...
I like that you're open about that uncertainty, because like that's basically what I mean, you still go through it. I still go through it now. But like a lot of people try to exert confidence throughout those first 3 years when really like authenticity works wonders, and like being very authentic of, of the crisis you were going through. So existential crisis phase, it's a like soul search. I guess what's the middle phase and then what's the now phase?
The middle phase is once you have conviction over what it is, it's then convincing everybody else. So then you have imposter syndrome, right? And you're like, well, I believe it, but they don't believe it. Am I crazy? Are they crazy? Where are we on this, right? Then when you actually get people to buy in, then all your problems become people and org problems. Like, I don't do a lot of the work anymore. I don't code anymore. I used to write every line of code, right? So it becomes about how can you motivate people to see the bigger vision? How can you empower them with the resources that they need to do their job? And that's a totally different skill set.
I think you've actually determined a way of explaining the beginning 3 years of a startup in the best way possible. Because I'm even having flashbacks to starting first company and second company, and like, yeah, the first phase is like, am I working on the right thing? Like, I don't know if this is the right thing. I know that there's something here, but I'm just going to keep poking at it. And it's not clear yet because I haven't talked to enough people. And then it's, you have to develop conviction that no one really else has on something that like no one believes. And like, that's for me, it was Bitcoin. Like, I had conviction on Bitcoin. Like,
that's that one we all got conviction on eventually, right?
Like, everyone got, and it took 5 years of people saying like, is that Bitcoin thing still a thing? And it's like very draining where you're like,
yeah,
your conviction needs to be stronger than the draining of talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've gone through that, it's people and org problems. I love it. That is the clear. Okay. With that, are you ready for the lightning round?
Yeah. Okay. Let's go. How does that work? Like, you ask and I answer in 10 seconds or?
Yeah. Well, it's really funny. It could go in other podcasts. Sometimes it goes longer, but I say lightning round and then I ask you a bunch of questions. So that's pretty much it. Lightning round. You are trapped on an island. You can only eat burritos for the rest of your life. What game are you playing?
What game am I playing?
Yeah. You're eating burritos. Like, what game are you playing?
I don't know. Do I have my cell phone?
Sure.
Oh, I.
No service, though. You can't call out for help. Or anything.
Oh, okay. What game? Like, just to entertain myself.
Yeah. Like, do you have a game that you play? And like.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I play a lot of threes. It's kind of like there was another version that was more popular, like 2048 or something.
I know. It's like the puzzle. It's like an evolution of Tetris in some ways. Like, it's a.
Sure. I would play Tetris too. Yeah. Okay. Any puzzle math type games.
Puzzle math. Sudoku. Like
Sudoku.
Sudoku. So you'd open a New York Times and you'd just be like, anything that can be put on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Okay. What is your favorite song to jam to when no one is watching?
Oh, it changes all the time. I don't know. Yeah, so actually on this, like, people always ask, what is your favorite song or what is your favorite genre? I don't have a favorite genre. I think every genre has amazing songs and they also have terrible songs. So,
well, this is to jam to, though. This is like, no one's watching.
Probably Taylor Swift.
I love Taylor Swift. My 6-year-old and 3-year-old just discovered Taylor Swift, and we've been
playing, you're in for a lot of Taylor Swift.
We've been playing Shake It Off a lot, and actually my 1-year-old is like able to dance to Taylor Swift.
Everything she does is amazing.
They watch the You Belong to Me music video and they're like obsessed with that music video. But it's like,
there's another really fun one that I think is great for kids. I think it's something like, it's called Me, like, I'm the only one of me.
Yes.
You're the only one of you. That one's super fun.
One's good.
Let's say that one. That's a good jam song.
Okay. Can you rhyme snout in a song lyric?
Oh, what would it be about?
Ooh, you just rhymed and I'm not sure you meant to.
I meant to do it. That's it.
What would it be about?
Yeah.
But snout. Okay, you did. And if you were to do a one-liner that was a rhyme for snout, what would it be? This isn't, I'm evolving the question.
You're evolving the question. I guess what vet care is all about.
See? Crush it. Okay, there's one person you can ask one question. Who's that person? What's that question?
That one I don't know. I want to hear your answer. What's your answer on that?
No, I get it. I get to ask.
You're only.
Okay, yeah. Here. I'll answer it.
You gotta roast you sometimes.
Okay, great job. Seriously? Seriously. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wow.
It's a very specific person, a very specific question.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of background to this, but basically it would be J.K. Rowling who wrote Harry Potter. And I would ask if she would write a parallel timeline of the entire Harry Potter series from the perspective of Fred and George Weasley.
Oh, okay. So some fan fiction.
Yeah. Like, I want 5 books and it's just Fred and George Weasley. And like, because I think that they're of the best entrepreneurs in all like stories of all fantasy stories. So
that's interesting. Yeah. I think like anytime you read a book, it's always like, well, there were 20 other characters and perspectives in there that we didn't get to see.
The best. Yes. And so I've actually thought about writing it, but obviously I'm not J.K. Rowling. I would rather J.K. Rowling write the fan fiction. But Ender's Game. So with Ender's Game, he did write a parallel timeline of a character named Bean for Ender's Shadow.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it's an amazing, I actually like Ender's Shadow better than Ender's Game. And like,
I'm going to have to read that then.
Okay.
Okay. So, I thought of my answer.
Okay. Go.
I think it would be Bill Gates. I think what's really interesting about Bill Gates is he's amassed this huge wealth, but he dedicates all of his time into thinking about how to spread it in the most efficient way. So I don't have a specific question, but something around, you know, his framework of thinking and how he goes about learning these problems.
This is amazing. So I just asked Spencer Skates the same question from Amplitude.
Yeah.
And he said Bill Gates also.
Yes. Okay. Well, so Spencer, Bill and I will go have dinner then.
So Bill Gates is doing something very interesting right now. He is.
I mean, I think the cool thing is he's not only doing these problems, he's kind of telling everybody else, like everybody wants to get involved. Everyone wants to give. And he's kind of giving everyone the roadmap. He's like, these are the problems.
I'm going to work through the process and then we can all help solve these problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I have 2 questions left. Okay.
All right.
2 people in the history of time you would want to have dinner with at one table.
Well, this dinner with Bill and Spencer could be fun. I think
now that you know that Spencer and
we can all go solve the problem.
We can all solve the problem.
Yeah,
I like it.
Let's do that. Let's do that, and you know, maybe bring in RBG.
That would be great.
Yeah, for some varying perspectives, you know.
Yeah, see, that's what I think would be interesting. Like, if you had one person, like, from way back in history, and then you see another dynamic human from our century, like, watching the differing opinions would be fascinating. Like,
yeah.
Change and, like, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay, last question. What is your definition of success?
I've actually given this a lot of thought recently. I wrote a personal manifesto, which I'm happy to share with you after. But my version of success is having all of the resources, whether that's money or power or the network, to solve any problem that I am really passionate about.
To solve problem. I like it. I wanted to write it down because I think you've thought hard about that and it's a good one. Okay. Well, thank you, Emily, for being on the Boost VC podcast. It's been great having you. And
yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
I love the energy.
Thank you so much for tuning in during your busy day to learn about sci-fi technologies. For more info on what we do, check out our website at www.boost.vc or give us a follow on Twitter and Facebook at BoostVC. A big thank you to Maddie Callender, Coy Lee, and Ben Lavelle for their support in creating and producing this podcast. A musical thank you to Melodrive and their AI composer for our amazing intro and outro songs. If you need music for your digital content, check them out at melodrive.com. Lastly, thanks to Tim Hollowell with the Podcast Group in Washington, who did an incredible job mixing this audio. Boost VC is all about helping amazing sci-fi tech succeed. If you have an idea you think we should hear, get in touch with us at boost.vc/contact. And make sure to sign up to get notified when applications open for the next Accelerator Tribe. Also, we love to hear from our listeners. So rate us and drop us a comment on whatever streaming service you use. We would love to hear feedback. That's it for this week, and unfortunately, we don't have enough time for Mark Zuckerberg. But be sure to tune in next week when he's available. This is Adam Draper signing off. Pew, pew, pew.